This is Dr. Shannon M. Clark with A Doctor Delivers Podcast, and today I am discussing pregnancy after 40 from preconception to delivery and health disparities with MFM Dr. Jasmine Johnson. Have a listen. Thanks everybody for joining me today. I have with me Dr. Jasmine Johnson, maternal fetal medicine specialist and assistant professor of clinical obstetrics and gynecology at Indiana University School of Medicine, which is right near where I'm from, Kentucky. I know Indiana very well. Yeah. I haven't lived there for a while, but my family's still there. So I'm very familiar with Indiana. And also she's on here on Instagram at Mrs. Mommy MD, MrsMommyMD. So make sure you go follow her there. The topic we chose today is to go over the paper that I published with a couple of my residents recently on pregnancy after 40 from preconception to delivery. But this is also Black Maternal Health Week. So doing my research for this topic and the health disparities that exist, particularly in this group of individuals after, you know, approaching age 40 and after age 40, there's a lot to unpack here and a lot to discuss. So I thought this would be a great opportunity to do so. Are you with me?
Yes. Yes. Excited to chat.
Yeah. Okay. So the first thing I wanted to talk about is when I was coming up, and I've been doing this a little bit longer, I'm not going to say how much longer than you have, you're up and coming. But when I was getting trained for the annual exams and what all we had to do on our checklist for annual exams, talking to individuals, especially those approaching age 35 and beyond, and specifically over age 40, talking to them about their fertility, family planning, what their goals were, was not on that checklist. Have things changed a little bit to where we're starting to address that more in the routine annual exams for the OBGYNs?
So I would say yes and no. They're definitely, I think, having trained at a multi-subspecialty area, there was more access to reproductive endocrinology and infertility care. So I feel like it was more on the forefront of our minds, thinking about how the patient in front of us might be impacted by needing fertility treatment in that regard. But I would say it's something that we definitely talk about, making sure that we're discussing reproductive goals with patients when we're thinking about residency training. But again, there's so much you have to talk about at those visits. Mm-hmm. And so I think that it's one of those things that falls by the wayside easily.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the important thing is we have to keep that in mind. And not just for those that are 35 to 40 and beyond, but at any time. Mm-hmm. You know, if it's not necessarily the annual exam, and also the patients can bring it up as well. It's never too early to talk about your fertility or what your plans might be, especially if you're planning on delaying childbearing for whatever reason, your training, your career, your schooling. It's better to go ahead and get that information and start having those conversations early. It's also very important, so we have to talk about this, if you're already at a disadvantage because your menstrual cycles are irregular, you got to talk about it sooner than later. What you don't want to do is wait until you're 35, 36, 37, already having had irregular menstrual cycles. You may not have really worried about it because you weren't planning to get pregnant anytime soon, but now you are, and we've got to play catch up. So if you are a patient listening to this, or you're a provider listening to this, we got to have those conversations. Would you agree?
Absolutely. And I love that your paper highlights when you should seek care from a physician if you've been trying to conceive, because I think that we don't do a good job of educating the community that, you know, if you're less than 35 and it's been a year without conception, you actually should seek care. And over 35, 6 months, I mean, that's not a lot of time. And so,
if you're already having regular menstrual cycles. If you're not, you got to go
right
than that.
That's assuming
you have. And then if you're over age 40, maybe a few months, but if not, just go earlier than that. So it's important to have these conversations, like Dr. Johnson said, and get a second opinion by a fertility specialist, because OBGYNs can do some things and some workup about fertility issues, but they're not fertility specialists, especially if you need something beyond that. So and it's not in all of our wheelhouses. I know that, you know, I went on to subspecialize, but, you know, in our training, we get some training about fertility, but not all OBGYNs that go out into private practice can do a full workup or can do IUIs or anything else related to fertility care. So talk to your doc, see what they're comfortable with and if they need to refer you out.
And also, I would just add, you know, a lot of patients are nervous to go talk to their doctor about a lot of things because they're just afraid of what the answer will be. And the best thing we can do is equip ourselves with knowledge of our health and fertility because you just don't know what you don't know.
Exactly. And then I wanted to add on to this topic, and this is something that people may not really think about, but it's true. There are disparities when it comes to even being talked having fertility issues at baseline. And there was a paper, and I shared it with Dr. Johnson. I'll just go over some of the stats, and we could talk about it. This study looked at three broad areas of concern with infertility. One of the things they found that provider decisions, meaning most commonly OBGYNs, about sterilization, meaning permanent sterilization, tubal ligations, and other forms of sterilization, treatment for ectopic pregnancy, the types of contraception that were offered or being offered, and even access to fertility care, they all complete to disparate outcomes for fertility treatment, meaning that all Black women are disproportionately affected by these decisions to for sterilization, meaning that they're offered or talked to or even with family members to get sterilization earlier than, say, non-Hispanic white counterparts. Their treatment for ectopic pregnancy is different. There's more of a providers are more inclined to just remove the tube as opposed to not. Fibroid care, delaying seeking treatment for fibroid care or being offered treatment for fibroids. All of those things can lead to fertility issues in the Black woman. Can you elaborate on that a little bit?
Absolutely. And when you think about disparities in general, I always like to take a step back and think about just the structural and historical context of all of these studies and what they're saying. And when we think about the Black woman and how we have interfaced with the medical system, we know that not only was there overt racism, there was bias and absolutely, like you're saying, provider decision making and kind of how it's infiltrated into medical education and thinking about Black women being seen as this hyper-fertile being going back to slavery. And so then these conversations of, well, she doesn't need any more children, or it's easier to do a self-injectomy than a tube-sparing procedure because she doesn't need more children. And so
Or
I
let's
just,
just let those fibroids go, or you know, we don't need to treat the fibroids, right?
She just needs a hysterectomy versus a myomectomy and that type of thing. And so I always am really interested in making sure that we think about the social and cultural context behind these studies, because one of the arguments when it comes to disparities is that Black women come into encounters more sick or kind of too far gone, when really we need to take a step back and look at all of the little things that led to the current state of
Yeah,
healthcare.
well, so why are they presenting later? You have to think about historically what has happened to their parents, their grandparents, their siblings through medical care that affects them and their willingness to seek medical care and their trust in the medical system in general. So racism is rooted in that, and it affects our patients. And one of the things I've talked about with other people in the similar forums is this, is when we see the difficult patient who is a Black woman, why is that? You know, you don't know what they brought into that room. And a lot of it is rooted in how they've been treated by the medical system. So until we take all those things into consideration, and we can't just label individuals as being difficult, you got to understand why. And as a medical, as especially in what we do as OBGYNs and MFMs, that is a huge part of what we deal with. And unless we're willing to acknowledge that as something as simple what seems as simple as fertility education, there are disparities there starting from the get-go. And we'll go into pregnancy and on, but those things have to be acknowledged. So what can we do as providers to better acknowledge that and accept it and talk about it?
Well, I think acknowledgement is the first step. If you're a provider, especially for non-Black providers, I think that there is a lot of hesitancy to bring up these issues. But I think we need to own it. We need to own that we need to revamp how we're practicing medicine, and we need to own our history. And so telling a patient, I understand that there are disparities when it comes to fertility treatment. How are you feeling about your reproductive health? Letting patients have a voice. One of the things, there was a recent paper in the Green Journal where they looked at Black women's experiences and perspective on their reproductive lifespan. And one of the themes that continued to come up in their interviews was that Black women feeling like they have to basically prepare for their visits by studying, bringing notes, doing their own research.
They have to arm themselves.
They don't want to feel like they aren't being given kind of standard of care treatment. And so I think it's so validating for someone who comes into a visit feeling like they have all this responsibility to manage their own care because they're worried their doctor's going to miss something. For your doctor just to acknowledge that, hey, I get it, and we're going to work together.
Yeah. So that is definitely a start. And then there was another study I wanted to just bring up that looked at the impact of any racial or ethnic disparities on just fertility awareness in general. And what they looked at were non-Hispanic whites and versus what they call minority groups, which included Black women and other minority groups. Basically, they found that in the minority group, they were significantly more likely to underestimate the rate of miscarriage, had lower awareness of the risk factors that can impact their fertility, were including like obesity and smoking, and whether or not they've had a history of any kind of sexually transmitted infection. They also appear to have a lower fertility awareness just in general about what we're going to talk about next, decreased egg quality, egg quantity over time with age. So all of that factors in. So our patients that are coming in as minority women and Black women are already at a disadvantage just from the get-go. And we have to bring that awareness to them and educate and bring it up because they're seeing us for their gynecologic care, obstetrical care. And as providers, we can do a lot to kind of bridge that gap. Would you agree with that?
I agree. And also, I think being innovative about meeting patients where they are. Similar like forums like this, I think are an opportunity for us to engage with communities that we may not reach just by virtue of patients being scared to go to the doctor. So absolutely.
With the other thing is decreasing the egg quality and quantity with age. And we've talked about that. When you age for any person, your eggs are going to decrease with how many eggs you have to ovulate versus the genetic content and the makeup, just because they have been in our bodies since we were born. And they sit there over time, they're more predisposed to having genetic issues once they join with the sperm, which could lead to pregnancy failure or pregnancy loss. So having those conversations as you approach 35 and especially over age 40, it's important to get that awareness and that knowledge because everybody needs that awareness, especially those that are at a disadvantage because they don't have that knowledge. So that's also something that needs to be considered. I know it's scary and people don't like to talk about that. And I just want to add that, and I'm sure you've seen this when patients come in who might have, I just had a patient the other day was having trouble conceiving almost age 40, but no one told her about this. No one told her. They sent her to me for a recurrent pregnancy loss workup when in reality with the issue was probably their age. So do you have those types of consults as well?
So being in the practice that I'm in right now, I don't see patients before they get pregnant most of the time. But in my residency training, absolutely, we had a lot of patients that would come after the fact and you just wish that they had had that conversation years before. It's so heartbreaking. And now as, you know, myself and my friend group, we're approaching age 35. I've really tried to have the conversations about freezing eggs and thinking about your fertility, even if you're not partnered, just because the minute you think that you might want to have a family, that's the time to start thinking about fertility preservation.
And I also think there's a hesitancy on the part of the provider as well to address their age, maybe because they don't want to offend the patient. But we have to get past that because age is a factor with fertility, whether we like it or not, whether we're healthy or not, it is. And we have to have those conversations. Avoiding it is not going to help the patient. So we have to be willing to have those conversations with our patients, especially if they have yet to conceive or they are further delaying their childbearing. It's very important that we do that as providers. The next thing I want to talk about is addressing medical conditions at any visit you have with the healthcare provider. If someone is over age 35 and especially over age 40 and they're taking medications for a chronic medical condition or they have a longstanding chronic medical condition, why is that so important in that age group?
Well, it's important for everyone, but we know that maternal mortality and severe maternal morbidity for the age group for those 40 and over is even more exacerbated. And so thinking about your pre-existing medical conditions, some of those things change during pregnancy. It can impact how your health changes over your lifetime. It can affect the health of your baby, the medications that you're on. Some of them aren't safe in pregnancy. And so all of that information is so valuable before you even conceive, because there are some proactive things that we can do to optimize health. beforehand. And so the best time to see us, I know I said I don't see a lot of patients before they get pregnant, but honestly, the best visits are preconception visits, because you just feel like you've kind of taken your power back and there are things you can do to optimize your health.
Right. I mean, and like it or not, as we age, we're going to develop diabetes, hypertension, other types of medical conditions. It doesn't mean that you can't get pregnant, but having those conditions optimally controlled before conception is ideal. But it's also important should you have a surprise pregnancy, which happens in an age group as well. Some have had several patients who didn't even realize they were pregnant until they were well into the first trimester. And then we're playing catch up. And not that myself or Dr. Johnson as MFM specialists who see these patients won't do our very best to get whatever condition you have under control and work with those medications. It's still a little bit of a disadvantage, right? I would rather have that addressed beforehand if I can. Would you agree with that?
Absolutely. And you hit the nail on the head, because I feel like I've had conversations with patients where they say, my doctor said I couldn't get pregnant, when really there was a disconnect. It was, you should not have a pregnancy right now. And so just being more upfront, like you said, not wanting to offend our patients, but just be honest with them about what our concerns are.
Yeah. And things have changed societal wise, and more people are delaying childbearing and having babies in their late 30s and 40s. And that's fine. This is not what this is about. It's about being realistic, taking control of your health, getting your health and your medications in order before trying to conceive or as early in pregnancy as possible, so that you can have the best pregnancy outcomes. Because like it or not, even if we're healthy over age 40 and we're working out every day like I was, we can still have medical complications based on our age alone in those pregnancies. So I know a lot of people get a little miffed when I say that, but it's true. Being over 40 and being pregnant does have its risk factors based on age alone. And we have to be okay with acknowledging that, because if we avoid it or ignore it, it's only going to hurt us. Right?
Doesn't go away. Right.
It doesn't go away. It doesn't go away. And I want to talk a little bit about the disparities in this group as well. You touched on the severe, we talk a lot about on social media about severe maternal morbidity and mortality. Explain to those listening, what exactly does that mean?
Yeah, so severe maternal morbidity is any adverse outcome or bad outcome that can happen in the context of a pregnancy that doesn't necessarily end in a maternal death. And the CDC has defined a number of conditions that qualify, but essentially it's any bad outcome. So if you needed to go to the ICU, if you needed a blood transfusion, those are kind of the big ones we use in research. And then maternal morbidity is a maternal death that occurs during a pregnancy or up to a year after pregnancy. And so we have maternal mortality review committees that kind of look at maternal deaths in that context and decide if they're pregnancy related or pregnancy associated, but not related.
And one of the things, and we won't go into this in depth too much, but one of the things that the United States has had an issue with is that every state has their little tweaks how they make define morbidity and mortality. There's not a lot of connecting between the states, and that's why it's hard to get statistics nationally really about what's happening. How do we define maternal morbidity? How do we define a maternal death? You know, and one thing that we need to do is kind of get all on the same page so that we can collect that data to better address it. And that's just my little two cents on that. I'm sure you know, you understand, you agree.
Agree.
Because there's too much. And and yes, we can get data, but it's a lot of times we don't get data on specific races and ethnicities because they're defined differently in the states or by the committees. That needs to all be standardized so we can get a better grip and a handle on who's being affected, what they're being affected with, so we can actually do something. Not that we can't now, but it would be a lot better if we had more of a standardization, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. And also if we incorporated patient families and patient stories in our reviews, which states are starting to do that, but a lot of the information we get is from birth certificate data or medical record data, which also does not tell the whole story.
Exactly. And let's just go over some stats about racial and ethnic disparities in severe maternal morbidity and mortality. Non-Hispanic Black women are 3 to 4 times more likely to die from pregnancy-related causes than non-Hispanic white women. Non-Hispanic Black women have maternal death rates up to 12 times higher in some cities in this country than their white counterparts. We also have increased pregnancy-related mortality that's elevated among Native Americans, Native Alaskans, Asian and Pacific Islanders. And then some subgroups of Hispanic women, including Puerto Ricans in specific regions within the United States itself. Regarding the specific, or for severe morbidity, for every maternal death, this was a stat I actually just saw recently. I didn't know this. For every one maternal death, 100 women suffer a severe obstetric morbidity. Mm-hmm. Just think about that for a second. What does that say to you?
Well, it says to me that we have a lot of people who have given birth who have been through something so traumatic. And I almost feel like that is an underreported statistic, because we've talked about the weaknesses in the data. And I think everyone has a relative or a friend that they've spoken to that has had a bad outcome. And so I think, again, the maternal health system needs to be revamped, and we need to look at what we're doing to produce these numbers.
Right. And just for defining a severe obstetric morbidity, that includes a life-threatening diagnosis or someone that has undergone a life-saving procedure during their delivery, hospitalization alone. That's not even including what happens once they're discharged and they might come back. That's during the actual delivery, hospitalization. Excuse me. And that to me is just, I do high-risk obstetrics and you do as well. And I see a lot of stuff, but that stat to me is just still is mind-blowing. And like you said, it's probably underrepresented. Racial and ethnic minority women have higher rates of severe maternal morbidity. In fact, and this is something that Dr. Johnson mentioned, non-Hispanic Black women had the highest rates for 22 of the 25 severe morbidity indicators used by the CDC. And like she said, when we look at morbidity and mortality, there's 25 different things. And I've actually done a post on this before. If out of the 25, and if you looked at that list, these things are not, they're significant outcomes and complications. Non-Hispanic Black women have the highest rates for 22 out of 25. Why is that?
Well, that's a loaded question. I think it goes back to what we were saying about fertility treatment. I wholeheartedly believe that structural racism, historical racism, all of those things are playing into what happens to a Black person when they interface with the healthcare system. And one of the things that just, when we are on this topic of disparities, I think a lot of the naysayers, because people still, there are still some people that don't believe that these statistics are accurate. One of the things that they try and say is kind of blame the patient, or the Black women are sicker, or they aren't seeking prenatal care, or they don't
because
have
insurance.
They're
not, they're non-compliant, or they're difficult. Like I said before, people are finding excuses. They're finding excuses, then owning it,
There are multiple studies to refute that claim even. Yep. And we know now that the protective factors that work for white women don't work for us. And the CDC report said that a Black woman with a college degree has a higher maternal mortality rate than a white woman who hasn't graduated high school. Right. And I think that says all we need to know.
Right. You wanted to talk about, I've talked about this before. This is the most recent data from February, 2022. Let's talk about this. This is from the National Center for Health Statistics, Health eStats. Maternal mortality rates in the U.S. for 2020. We're about two or more years behind reporting these types of stats. This is typical. Let's talk about this document a little bit. What did you want to bring up about this? And I wanted to show, I wish there was a way I could show this.
Which I know.
Does that make sense? Yeah, go ahead and talk about that.
Yeah, well, I was really excited when this report came out, because like you said, usually we get our maternal mortality data 5 years after the fact. Yeah. And so this just highlights what we knew about the pandemic. So we already knew that communities that were already disproportionately affected by health disparities, that gap just increased with COVID. And this report just highlights that in 2020, the maternal mortality statistics worsened for everyone, but we saw that they worsened the most for non-Hispanic Black women. And on the topic of our paper today, just thinking about the age-related risk, that the chart that you highlighted for the 40 and over group, looking at maternal mortality, we just, I think I wrote it down. Let me see. I can't find it.
Yeah. No, it's right here. You got it. Go ahead.
Yeah, for non-Hispanic white women in the 40 and over group,
the maternal mortality rate was 96.8 deaths per 100,000 live births. So that's how we report the maternal mortality ratio. And just to put that into perspective, in 2018, I think the overall maternal mortality ratio was like 17 to 18 deaths per 100,000 live births. And for non-Hispanic Black women, the maternal mortality ratio for 2020 was 263 deaths per 100,000 live births.
For
the 40 and over group.
For the over age 40 group?
For the over age 40 group, yes, yes. Yeah. And then for Hispanic women, it was 86 deaths per 100,000 live births. And so one of the weaknesses also in our data is that we don't have really good granularity on race. Like you said, we routinely have reported out non-Hispanic Black, non-Hispanic White, Hispanic, but we all know that there's so much heterogeneity within those groups. And cultural differences. So we need to do a better job of that as well.
There's some reports I've even read where they'll put an asterisk and say, we don't have any data for this group. Like none.
Right.
None. I mean, how can that be? So yeah, there's definitely, we're at a disadvantage for those of us that really want to dive into this and figure it out, just trying to even get a grasp on exactly what's going on, just by the way things are reported. So let's talk, you already talked about medications and compliance, and I just want to touch on this real quick. If you're on chronic medications for any reason, the important thing is for you to, your health to be controlled. But if you're thinking about trying to conceive, or you find yourself pregnant, surprise, you know, as a surprise, and you are especially over age 35 and 40, it's best to talk to your provider sooner than as soon as possible. But don't just stop everything cold turkey. That's not ideal either. Right. They do this for everybody, much less those over age 40. But they'll say stop everything. You're pregnant, and I've even had providers tell them to stop their seizure meds, their diabetes meds. Yeah. And I'm just like, what are we doing? Don't do this. Someone tells you to don't do that, right? What is going on with providers doing this?
That, and also psychiatric medications. You know, we are always talking about how mental health is just as important as other physical health issues. And a mom who is fully whole in that regard is going to be the best mom she can be. So please don't stop all medications. Please come talk to a maternal fetal medicine doctor so that if we need to switch things, we can.
Yeah. And it's, you don't want to enter with a chronic medical condition, then stop your meds and then try to go into the first trimester. It's going to make things so much worse, but I understand the concern. We're not discounting the concern. We understand anybody that's pregnant, they're concerned about what they're taking. But what we do know, and we have lots of data to back this up, especially with mental health disorders, is having an untreated pregnant person is much worse for the pregnancy than what any medication we can give them to treat their condition. There are a handful of medications that you actually don't want to take in pregnancy. So if you're on one of those medications or you're concerned about it, ask, because if you're thinking about potentially getting pregnant, or there's a chance you could get pregnant on, you know, not intentionally, you might want to tweak that medication a little bit. So there are some things that we can do, but it's so important. I get a lot of patients who were told to stop their medications, or they did it on their own because they were just scared. But I'm sure you get those patients as well, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And also situations where we may prescribe something for a patient and then they go to fill it and the pharmacy then tells them that they shouldn't be taking it in pregnancy. It's very frustrating.
Magnus, they even do that with low-dose aspirin.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Go ahead, and then we'll talk about the pharmacist.
and I think that just speaks to the fact that we all work in silos, and there just needs to be better collaboration amongst teams, and that we are all partnering to get the best outcome for our patients.
Yeah, and I've talked to some of my PharmDs and pharmacy colleagues, and they're doing better about getting training about the pregnant and trying to conceive individual. Not everybody's quite on board yet. I get that. But if there's a question, I think we need to have a collaboration where the pharmacist who's filling the prescription calls the provider to just double check. I understand the concern, and they do the best they can. But sometimes it's just overwhelming because I'm like, I wouldn't give them low dose aspirin if it wasn't
right.
But I get it. I don't want to bash pharmacists. I don't. Or PharmDs. I don't want to do that. But we have to be more collaborative rather than, because what happens is, they'll say to the patient that goes to pick up, you can't take that.
Right.
And so that puts distrust between the patient and the provider who prescribed that medication. When what mm-hmm. should happen is they should call us and say, I have questions before I fill this for this patient, in order to not break that trust there. Because then the patient's like, well, the pharmacist told me you prescribed this.
Right.
And we don't want to do that. Right. So that's, I wish there was more of a collaborative effort between us as providers, rather than telling the patient that your doctor prescribed you a medication that they shouldn't have prescribed. Right.
Exactly. And it's our responsibility to communicate to our patients what we're giving them, and giving them a heads up that we actually want to prescribe things that are safe for them in their pregnancy. And if they have concerns, we're here.
Yeah. All right. Let's jump to IVF pregnancies are increasing in those over age 40. And I'm one of them. I have my twins 9 days shy of my 43rd birthday. So one of the reasons why we're seeing more persons over age 40 conceiving is because of the advances in assisted reproductive technology. And myself, and I'm sure Dr. Johnson, we get a lot of these patients who have mm-hmm. conceived via IVF in this age group. But unfortunately, we have to acknowledge the fact that there are some increased risks associated with this age group and those who have had IVF pregnancies. For example, just at baseline, regardless of age, actually, patients conceiving through assisted reproductive technology are at increased risk for morbidity compared to those pregnancies not conceived through ART. There's increased risk with adverse fetal and pregnancy outcomes, such as perinatal mortality, birth defects, prematurity, and low birth weight. And then if you look at those over age 40 with the twins and more, you add that, also an example, it's also going to add further risk on top of that. So mm-hmm. when you see your patient who is coming to you pregnant, multiples or not, with an IVF pregnancy, are there any things that's on your radar for these patients?
Yeah, absolutely. So one of the things that we talk to patients about in our practice is there is some data out there about increased risk of congenital heart defects. And so mm-hmm. that's when we have a conversation about what additional ultrasounds may be necessary in pregnancy to screen for that. And so that would be where the fetal echocardiogram comes into play. And that is a special ultrasound where they just mm-hmm. focus on looking at the baby's heart anatomy. And mm-hmm. depending on where you are and what practice you go to, there's some mixed messaging when it comes to that study, but that's kind of our general practice right now. Other things we talk about are the medical risk mm-hmm. of pregnancy. So preeclampsia, I feel like patients that have gone through assisted reproductive technology, there is so much anxiety leading up to that pregnancy and anxiety in our visits to get that first anatomy scan done. And so my first job is to hopefully bring some of the anxiety down, but equipped with knowledge. And so we always say, we're not trying to scare you, but these are the mm-hmm. things that we're thinking about. So preeclampsia and talking mm-hmm. about aspirin, it looked like someone commented about what is aspirin for? And so we're referring to 81 milligrams of aspirin, or other people refer to it as baby aspirin. And mm-hmm. it's something that we recommend in those who are at a high risk for developing preeclampsia. So we have guidelines, and there's a list. I think you've posted that list mm-hmm. before yes. as well. And so if you have a high risk factor or a number of moderate risk factors, you qualify for getting a baby aspirin. And so mm-hmm.
And IVF pregnancy, IVF pregnancy is one of the moderate risk factors. But if you had IVF pregnancy plus over age 40 or over age 35, that gives you two moderate risk factors, which puts you qualified, if you will, for taking low-dose aspirin once daily.
Exactly. Other things we talk about, fetal growth restriction, or that mm-hmm. the baby may not grow as well. And so that may mean extra ultrasounds, thinking about pregnancy outcomes for mom and increased risk of hemorrhage and maybe needing a C-section, all of those things. And so, it sometimes I feel like I'm doom and gloom in these conversations mm-hmm. and try and bring the mood up, but there's definitely a lot to discuss.
Yeah. And I went through it myself. I did. I checked off every box for someone who was over 40 with IVF and twins. I did. And, you know, sometimes I talk about these things on here and people tell me I'm fear mongering. It's not fear-mongering, it's being realistic. These are the realities, and we can't ignore them. We have to educate on them to empower patients. The more they know, the more empowered they can be about their care and their pregnancy care. So like it or not, these are the stats and these are the data, and not talking about it is not going to make it go away. If we did that, then it's not going to be on providers' radars. It's not going to be on your radar. And the more people that's thinking about it, especially say signs of preeclampsia and those over age 40, signs of abruption, you know, what do I do about diabetes, any of these things, the better your pregnancy outcome is going to be. I'm not fear mongering, and neither is Dr. Johnson. This is just what we know, and this is what we do every day with our job, and it's our job to empower our patients, right?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Absolutely. And we took an oath, first do no harm, and mm-hmm. our first responsibility to our patients is to let them know what we know. We've done a lot of training to get this information, and hopefully it allows them to make better decisions about their health in the long run.
I almost feel sometimes it's a no-win situation, because we cannot say anything about it, and then it'll happen. They'll be like, well, why didn't you tell me? Or we tell them in preparation. They say, well, you're trying to scare me. So we have to find a balance there. You know, mm-hmm. one of the things, I forget where I've heard this, but it's actually a very good quote. Just because your pregnancy is considered high risk does not mean your risk is high. So we still have to take the individual that's considered high risk because they're over age 40, because they might have a multiple gestation, or they have diabetes, they have high blood pressure. We know what the baseline risks are there, but you can still have a very healthy and successful pregnancy. We just have to know what's going on and not ignore it. And we got to look for those red flags, what you're at increased risk for, and take care of it. So again, it's not saying everybody over age 40 is going to experience all these complications, but we definitely just can't not talk about it or ignore it, right?
Yeah, I love that. Just because
you're high risk doesn't mean your risk is high.
You're right. I like that.
Yeah. I wish I remember. And if somebody's listening that knows where that came from, I want to give them that credit, but I didn't steal it. I promise. I just don't remember where I saw that. So let's talk a little bit about IVF in Black women, and especially those who are age 40. There are some studies on this, and there is one that looked at racial and socioeconomic characteristics of those seeking fertility care. And they found that Black women were more likely to report that their race was a barrier to getting fertility treatment just at baseline, compared with white, Hispanic, and Asian individuals. And then Black and Hispanic women were approximately twice as likely to report that their income level, their weight, were also barriers to them getting fertility care. I know this is not either one of our wheelhouses, it's not what we do, but it's important for us to know as with what we do, because we have to see what our patients have been exposed to or what their journey may have been like before they got to us, because this is a reality. Yeah. There's another study that looked at barriers, and they found that, and you touched on this, Black women report feelings of shame, guilt, and failure as an aversion to even seeking fertility care. And you talked about the stigma or the myth that the Black woman is hyperfertile. And this is rooted in racism and historical context as well, that is thought. And so that's also how they might feel internally. So when they can't get pregnant, they feel like they failed, and they might be too ashamed to go seek that treatment. Can you expand on this? Is this something that you've seen with any of your patients before?
Well, I think it just goes back to what we were saying about patients not seeking help in a timely fashion, because they are thinking that there is an internal flaw with them that other people don't experience. And similar to miscarriage, I don't think we talk about infertility enough and how common it is. And in the Black community, I think there's starting to be more dialogue about it and internet resources and things. But going back to just access to care, we know that fertility treatment is very expensive. Mm-hmm. And very few jobs have fertility treatment coverage. And then I Googled it yesterday just to see kind of what types of jobs offer coverage. And a lot of the jobs that offer fertility treatment coverage are in tech and corporate America. And we know that there's not a lot of diversity in those professions. So it then self-selects for a certain type of person being able to get fertility care. And I think there was a study you brought up in Chicago where there was state mandated fertility coverage, and they still saw a disparity where Black patients weren't necessarily seeking it as frequently. And then of those who then got IVF, they didn't have as successful of cycle.
Right.
So I, again, similar to the maternal mortality crisis, all of these issues are so multifaceted, and there's not going to be one solution. So giving everyone access obviously isn't the solution. The only solution. We need to dig a little bit deeper.
We've got to do better job of even for fertility is leveling the playing field a little bit, because you know there's so many reasons why minorities may not seek fertility care based on what their experiences have been, or any shame or guilt for not being able to conceive. I see it a lot with fibroids, you know, delaying getting that treatment and getting those managed. And then the next thing you know, they're in the late 30s, early 40s with fibroids and still not able to conceive, and then trying to get that managed. So we, you know, talking about it, normalizing it, destigmatizing it for Black women and other minority groups is what we have to do in order to encourage them to seek care. But also, when you're going to seek care, they still feel that, like, they're not treated the same. So there's still an onus on the providers to level that playing field so they don't feel that way. There's nothing worse, and I'll give you an example. But in another facility, not here, for their chronic hypertension, the provider, a preconception consult, which number one is not done a lot, but they did this, her and her spouse, to try to get things under control before they tried to conceive. And they were not started on meds. They were not given baby aspirin. They were given no recommendations. So we have to do a better job when patients are coming to us for whatever it is to give them that what they're seeking and not dismissing. We have to look at our own biases to see if that's playing in how we're treating or managing this patient as opposed to this one, because it's still happening, right? I'm sure you see that as well.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And I think that it gets even more stark when we think about patients that do have a private insurance carrier versus patients who are publicly insured or uninsured, and providers making assumptions about what patients want to spend or what patients can afford. And that's not our call. And everybody needs to have all of the options presented to them. And I also always tell patients, if you feel like your doctor isn't listening to you, if you feel like a concern that you're voicing outside of pregnancy, in pregnancy, thinking about preconception isn't being valued, then it is okay to switch doctors. And we spend so much money on healthcare in this country, but we still have patients that walk away from their encounters feeling like they were talked at and not listened or disrespected outright. And it's not okay.
It's not okay. Okay, I want to jump on. We're going to go by first, second, third trimester and delivery, just talking about how, as maternal fetal medicine specialists or even as general OBGYNs, how things might differ a little bit for those that are over age 40. First trimester, is there anything differently that we should be doing when we have a patient that's pregnant for the first time or second, third, or fourth time who's now over age 40?
Yeah. So kind of piggybacking on our preconception visit. So if we haven't had someone in their preconception visit, first trimester is like that rapid fire visit to get all of those medical history details updated, making sure that medications are appropriate, and then thinking about screening. So one of the things that we know is higher in that age group is gestational diabetes. And, and so those patients should have early screening or an assessment of their blood sugars earlier in pregnancy. And then we would do that again later in the second trimester. And so that is one thing we think about. And then also thinking about hypertension and preeclampsia. Mm-hmm. So getting a baseline assessment, we call them preeclampsia labs. I don't know if you call them that over there.
Yeah, we do.
Or health labs.
I call them tox labs, but yeah.
Oh, okay. Yeah. And so looking at like their CVC, and we want to make sure that their blood counts and platelet counts are appropriate, and their liver function and kidney function is all at baseline what we would expect it to be. Some providers might even ask their patient to collect their urine for 24 hours so that they can get a most accurate assessment of urine protein. And all of that is really just to establish a baseline so that if there is a condition that hadn't previously been diagnosed, we're aware of it in the first trimester. But also if complications do develop later on, we have something to compare it to.
Yes. Yeah, and one of the things I want to talk about too is antenatal screening. And antenatal screening is the various, we have a bunch of ways to do antenatal screening to look for the risk that the fetus might have a chromosomal defect. We know, and this is not talking about anyone over age 40 who conceived via donor egg. If they conceive via their own eggs spontaneously or even with IVF, you know, antenatal screening is still important. It's still recommended that if you conceived over age 40 with your own eggs, and you even had those tested, PGT tested, you should still get antenatal screening because there are things that can happen during the development of the fetus that could still cause a chromosomal defect. So that's still recommended. But antenatal screening, I hear a lot that, oh, I don't want that because it doesn't matter. I'm going to keep my baby. I wouldn't terminate. That's not the only reason to get antenatal screening. Right. One of the things that I see a lot in those who decline it is they come back for their second trimester scan, which in those over 40, it's going to be a detailed assessment, and we'll talk about that. And we see something, not necessarily a major birth defect, but things that we call minor markers. And they don't have that baseline screening. And it's a little bit more difficult to counsel them about what that means in the pregnancy. When you get the antenatal screening, it'll give you a numbers risk about what the potential risk is for having a chromosomal defect in that pregnancy that you're carrying. When we have that and we can add whatever we see on the ultrasound of that, we can counsel you in numbers, which is a little bit easier to digest. So having the information is not just because you would do something or act on it, but if you see something on ultrasound, it helps us to better educate and counsel you about what that means for your pregnancy. Do you see that in some of your patients as well?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. And I feel like we don't talk about the limitations of screening as well as we should too, just because I think some patients come in and they've had the screening and they're like, there's no chance my baby could have anything. Mm-hmm. And although our screening is really good, it's not 100%. And so talking about just all of the nuances of testing sometimes can get overwhelming for patients, but thinking about screening, but also diagnostic testing with an amniocentesis is something that we always touch on for moms in this age group.
Yeah, and anyone over age 35, and I believe this is pretty much in every state, can get, just based on age alone, can get a diagnostic test, whether it's with CBS or an amniocentesis. It is supposed to be covered by insurance companies. So I hope that's the case. But that's just based on age alone. Again, you don't have to have that done. It's not something that's required, but it's something that most all of us, I know I do, and I'm sure you do too, that's something that's going to be discussed. And again, it's not to tell you that, something's going to be wrong, but it's your right to know that you have that option. And sometimes people get a little put off when I bring it up, but that's what my job is to talk to you about all these things and the realities of being pregnant, especially over age 40. So again, it's still your option. Genetics counseling is also an option as well. Some MFMs, my group, we do a lot of genetics counseling, but not all MFM groups do, and they utilize a genetics counselor. So you might have the consult with Dr. Johnson or myself and see a genetics counselor or have that opportunity as well. So that's another option that you can use to investigate more, talk more about what your risk is of having a fetus that's affected with the chromosome. Talk about the difference between someone advanced maternal age, this is over age 35 and especially over age 40, getting a detailed anatomy scan and a fetal echo versus someone who's of a younger age group just getting a basic scan. What's the difference between those two types of ultrasound assessments?
Yeah, so really kind of high level, the difference is the amount of images that we take. We have, based on our ultrasound guidelines, there's a society, AIUM is kind of what we look at when we're thinking about ultrasounds. There's a checklist that we have for kind of a basic scan. And so that's going to be someone who does not have a condition that predisposes them to having a fetus affected by birth defects. And then there's the extensive scan. And the extensive scan looks at each structure in more detail. And so it is a scan that you automatically get when you're age 35 and above. And then the fetal echo, as I stated before, is a scan exclusively for the fetal heart. And so that is something that we also have a kind of a guideline on who qualifies for getting that scan. Or if something comes up during your basic scan, it might put you on the track to getting an extensive scan or a fetal echo. So there's definitely some fluidity in who gets what.
Yeah, but most individuals over age 40 are going to get that detailed anatomy scan and the fetal echo. And that's just where we're looking at a lot more views of the baby to look for. And I don't know how you describe it. This is how I describe it. When we look at the baby, we're looking for two types of things. The first would be the obvious, the major birth defects or major defects, like a cleft lip, a hole in the heart, something anatomically structurally wrong with the brain. Those types of things would need to be addressed once the baby's born and could potentially cause there to be certain effects in the baby as the baby grows. Whereas if you look for minor markers, and there's a whole list of them, I won't go through all of them, but one of the most common ones you might hear of is an echogenic intracardiac focus. What's the other one? The choroid plexus cyst. Those types of things are called minor markers. They're not birth defects. They don't cause dysfunction of the baby. When you start to see more than one, then it does alter the risk of the fetus having, potentially having a genetic abnormality or chromosomal defect. So those are really the two categories we see. So you may see a major defect, you may see one or two minor markers, even in those under age 35, that might change that basic anatomy scan to a more detailed anatomy scan or extensive scan. But when we're talking about those over age 40, they're going to get that extensive scan where we're definitely looking at the minor markers and the major defects. It's also important, again, when we have any kind of antenatal screening to, when you see those types of things, to better counsel the patient as well.
Exactly.
One thing I also want to talk about is the increased risk of stillbirth in those over age 40. Again, this is another thing that people don't like to hear, but why do we need to talk about this? Why do we need to educate and counsel about this?
Well, again, I think if it was me as the patient and I had an outcome like stillbirth, I would feel slighted and heartbroken if it had never been brought up to me. And I think that it's important to talk about these risks so that we can minimize them and do what we can to decrease risk. And so for us, when we think about increased risk of stillbirth, that's when we start to introduce antenatal testing or some type of assessment of the fetus during pregnancy. And so some of you may be familiar with the non-stress test, where you go to the office and your doctor monitors baby's heart rate and contraction activity. And it's just an assessment of fetal well-being. Or again, that's a way that we use ultrasound. And so for those over age 40, antenatal testing is typically recommended, and your paper does a great job of stating that, you know, there aren't super clear guidelines, but I think the general consensus is that that risk of stillbirth is increased, and so there needs to be some discussion and also probably some antenatal testing.
Yeah, so if you're thinking about antenatal testing, again, Dr. Johnson mentioned non-stress tests, and then another common one might be a biophysical profile. When we do those for the start antenatal testing for someone with like diabetes or high blood pressure or some other type of fetal or maternal complication, that's typically done at 32 weeks. But if you're talking about age alone, if you're just, you're 41 and that's it, so not everybody does it. Some people do, and then but there's no recommendations, and it hasn't been shown that based on age alone that it changes neonatal outcomes or pregnancy outcomes during surveillance. But if you're over age 40 and you don't have another medical reason to do antenatal surveillance, you may want to talk to your doctor about it. Whether it's starting NSTs at a certain gestational age, it's probably not going to hurt, but there's no evidence that it helps either, just based on age alone. We have more of the evidence if you have age plus chronic hypertension, age plus diabetes, age plus fetal growth restriction, then that becomes more clear. But, you know, it's definitely something to be considered. And I don't think we made a hard recommendation just based on the age alone, but it's something that definitely needs to be considered and discussed, right?
No, you did not. Yeah. And also just having trained in a different place where I'm now practicing, there's nuances between institutions. And so don't be surprised if you're talking to your provider and they say something that might be a little bit different than what we're talking about here. And I think that is a perfect opportunity to just bring up your concern. And if it's something you've read about and just want to know why you do or do not get testing, that is a great question.
Let's talk about delivery and then we're going to wrap this up. Okay. The first thing I want to talk about is I hear a lot. My doctor said I'm 39, I'm 42. I have to be induced at 39 weeks or I have to deliver by C-section. What are your thoughts on either one of those recommendations? Yeah. I mean, honestly, babies over 35, I hear it all the time. That providers
I know you do. I've heard it.
I hear it. You know, I know, but it's happening a lot. So let's talk about first. They're over age 40. And is induction at 39 weeks an absolute?
So nothing is an absolute. I tell my patients when we give recommendations about delivery, that is based on the guidelines we've established from studies. Some of those studies are more recent and some aren't.
And some are better than others.
And some are better than others. And so our recommendation that someone over 40 should be delivered at 39 weeks comes from the stillbirth risk and the increased risk of stillbirth after the due date. But I tell my patients, if this is something that, like, if you just see their heartbreaking when you're talking about an induction because they want it to go into natural labor, it's something that it can be an ongoing conversation, but I think we just have to be very clear about what the risks are and why we're giving our recommendation. And so, again, just joint decision-making when it comes to those conversations. And then as far as cesarean delivery, by I absolutely support vaginal birth, and our recommendation would be that anyone who is willing to attempt for a vaginal birth should get that opportunity, especially because it decreases the risk of postpartum complications. Mm-hmm. Thinking about severe maternal morbidity and the things that we discussed earlier in the conversation, a cesarean delivery is a major surgery. We do them all the time, but it's still a major surgery. Mm-hmm. And so a vaginal birth is definitely a more optimal delivery mode if that's the safest mode that's determined.
Yeah, and we're talking about just getting a recommendation for cesarean just based on your age. Now, someone who's had cesareans in the past, that's a different ballgame because you're always
exactly
going to have an elective repeat. But if someone tells you you've never had a cesarean, but they say you're 40, you need to have a cesarean, there's no recommendation. There's no data to support that. Now, we do have some studies that show that those over age 40 are at increased risk for having a cesarean, and that's true. Mm-hmm. There is an increased risk. We don't really know physiologically why that is, but some problems with the rest of labor or failure to progress that would end in a cesarean section. But it's not that everyone, that's not saying that everybody needs to have a C-section that's over 40. I am very pro vaginal birth. I am very pro trial of labor after cesarean in all my patients. So, and again, I this is where we're practicing. We have the facilities to do that. We have the resources to offer that to all of our patients, but there's no reason that you have to have a C-section just based on age alone. For induction of labor, what we wrote on our paper is elective induction, especially with some of the newer studies that we have about the benefits and other patients, otherwise low-risk patients for induction of labor at 39 weeks, it should be considered in those over age 40. However, with the shared decision-making, meaning between what the patient wants and what the provider has recommended, the patient says to me, I want to see what happens. Okay, then I might say, you know what, let's go to 40 weeks. If you're still wanting to keep going on, then I'm definitely going to institute NSTs or BPPs. Mm-hmm. But I have to admit, and I will tell my patients this, if you're over age 40 and you're hitting that past 40 week mark, I'm going to be nervous and I'm going to be worried. Yeah. I am. That's based on what I know. That's based on what the data shows, but that's my conversation and they have to be comfortable as well. Induction of labor or elective induction of labor, meaning after 39 weeks, is not something that has to be done for anyone. It's a recommendation. Mm-hmm. And what you do is you talk about why you're recommending elective induction after 39 weeks, what the pros and cons are, and then what does the patient want? But you got to give them that information. And being over age 40, continuing your pregnancy much past 40 weeks is a risk factor for having some adverse outcomes. And we have to address that, right?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I can't say enough that it's our job to tell you all of the possibilities. And then you have to make the best decision that you as the patient feel comfortable with, because I think it goes back to disparities and talking to patients about what they want versus what they felt like their provider wanted, and the dichotomy of patients not feeling listened to. I think everyone deserves to feel like their voices were heard and they were a partner in their care.
Yeah, I think it's the being talked at, or I'm the doctor and this is what I do. But we gotta give them a why. Why? I mean, if my 5-year-old asks me why, I'm going to try to explain why. Why would I not do that with my patients? You know, but for some reasons we're hesitant to do that. And I hear that all the time, but you know, especially when it comes to something that has a gray area or some wiggle room, we've got to allow them that wiggle room if that's what they want. But it's our job also to give their whys, or I do personally do this, or this is my recommendation based on what ACOG says, what SMFM says, what this newest study says, what my personal experience is, what I know about you as a patient, what I know about your history. These are the reasons why I'm recommending this. We are allowed to do that. We can't just go in and just wield our doctor hat and say, this is what I know is best and you need to just accept it.
Right. No questions.
Yeah, no questions. So, you know, that's that. We went through everything I wanted to go through. We're not going to have time to go through all these questions. So if you submitted questions, unless you have a few more minutes, do you have a few more minutes?
Unfortunately, I have to bounce to another meeting. I'm sorry.
Perfect. Okay. So I'm going to let you go. What we'll do is put the questions in the comments under this video. We'll do a part two.
I would love
that. Answer some questions. Okay. Thank you so much, Dr. Johnson. Enjoy the rest of your day.
Thank you for having me. See you later.
Bye-bye. I hope you enjoyed that discussion. Now listen to the next episode on National Infertility Awareness Week with reproductive endocrinology and infertility specialist, Dr. Lucky Seacon.